Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Welcome to our next episode of the EAN podcast, and this time we have a special guest from Baltimore. It's Dan Gold. Maybe you can introduce yourself.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here at 6 a.m. in Baltimore time. So I'm a neurologist at Johns Hopkins. I did a fellowship in neuroophthalmology, but these days my practice is really heavily kind of efferent, eye movements, and vestibular. Did an informal additional training in vestibular neurology. So even prior to COVID, have been involved a bit in telemedicine, so I'm happy to talk about my experience.
Okay, so this is certainly a topic that has become quite important during the COVID pandemic. And so how do you do it actually?
Yeah, so I guess I should probably start from the beginning. And we have had a quote, teledizzy service, unquote, a consultation service, clinical consultation service in the Johns Hopkins Hospital since about 2017. And what we've been doing is a patient comes in acutely dizzy or vertiginous into our hospital, and our technician goes down with video oculography goggles and does a full battery of ocular motor and vestibular testing, including the Hintz exam, including positional testing. And so we've been doing this since 2017, collecting a history in addition to that battery of tests has been really good at triaging a lot of patients, especially with BPPV, especially those patients with the acute vestibular syndrome. So what we were able to do at the beginning of COVID is kind of pivot and use that teledizzy kind of protocol for a lot of our outpatients. I guess we're cheating a little bit because in most cases, those patients have gone downtown and had a full battery of tests with our technicians, and then we're seeing them virtually after the fact. So we have a lot of data about their eye movements, a lot of data about the vestibular system before seeing them virtually.
Okay, so actually, how do you bring this interview home to the patient? So how do you do this technically? Because you need to be quite tech-savvy in order to handle this.
Right. So at the very beginning, when everything shut down for COVID, the patients stopped going to the emergency department, those dizzy patients, and they stopped calling to make appointments with us as well. We quickly had to pivot. We were doing zero telemedicine for outpatients, so we had to pivot and get that part of our practices up and running. So it was a challenge trying to understand what platforms worked, what didn't, what were the limitations. And it is, if you want to do a complete battery of ocular motor and vestibular tests, everything that we could do in the clinic in person and in 10 to 20 minutes, it could take an hour or 2 hours to get all of the lighting correct and the distance and the cameras and the angles. So it was a lot of trial and error. And at the beginning, just trying to, this patient sounds like they have BPPV. Let's try to get them into a safe position on the floor to do a Dix-Hallpike, for instance. So there's no perfect formula for this. It is really dependent on the patient, the technology, the connection, and 800 other factors.
Okay, so what do these patients actually use? So what kind of smartphone, tablet, and do they actually need an extra cameraman at home, or can they do that everything on their own?
Yeah, so I guess I would say if the cameraman has a steady hand or camera woman has a steady hand, then that works great. Oftentimes somebody else is better than the patient trying to do 8 things at once and hold the camera at the right angle, but It has been a challenge. I'll tell you that of the platforms that we've used, in my experience, FaceTime has worked very, very well. And a lot of the other platforms have not worked quite as well, including our kind of homegrown Johns Hopkins platform here. So it's really variable.
Okay, so what are the strengths? So in which situations, exams, does it work best then?
Yeah, so I think for the purposes of somebody has nystagmus, they have the complaint of oscillopsia. I think it's pretty good if you know what you're looking for. I think that probably even more important than frames per second would be just making sure that the camera is steady, that the lighting is good. So the patient I've found kind of standing in front of a window, that natural light works best. And the positioning of the head. So if I'm looking for a spontaneous downbeat, I'm having them look out the window, camera close to their eyes, or sometimes if they can't position it over both eyes simultaneously, let's just pick one eye to look at, to focus in on. Look at distance, and if there's going to be pendular or jerk nystagmus or some oscillation or some intrusion, square wave jerks, I've found that that's a really nice way to look at it. Then it becomes an additional challenge looking for gaze evoked because the patient has to reposition things. So just rather than having the camera move, keep the camera in the same spot and move the head. So it's a lot of head positioning. So just turn the head to the right and keep looking at that target that I told you to look at out the window. Now they're looking to the left and you can look for gaze evoked nystagmus.
That sounds interesting. But, you know, I was wondering, what I'm sometimes telling my patients is to record paroxysmal events. So whenever they get dizzy, please record your eye movements. Are you doing things like that as well?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I've been doing that. I'm sure you've been doing that for many years. We see a lot of these patients, and these patients come to the emergency department as well, where they have episodic vestibular syndrome or maybe a first attack. But by the time they get to you in clinic, by the time they get to the ED, it's obviously gone. And it's pretty rare that a patient has one of their typical attacks in the clinic, although it does happen. So I've been doing this for years where I tell patients, please take a close-up video of your eyes with good lighting the next time you have one of these attacks. And I've got a library, as I'm sure you do, a library of these home videos from patients of different patterns of nystagmus from Meniere's and vestibular migraine and TIAs. So absolutely, that can be very helpful.
So this brings me to another question. So if you save them at home, do you also save them in your patient charts, or what do you do with these recordings then?
Yeah, so for me, I have a collection through the North American Neuro-Ophthalmology Society, through the Neuro-Ophthalmology Virtual Education Library. Hopefully there'll be a link to this somewhere in or around this podcast. For people to go check out. This is free and accessible to all, but that's where I've been putting a lot of these videos. Unfortunately, we don't have a mechanism as of today. Hopefully in the coming months we will, to actually save a video of a patient's eye movements into their medical chart.
Yeah, because this is certainly more helpful for the patient if you can go back and see what happened at that time.
Yes, I agree. Unfortunately, we've been unable to achieve that.
And so actually, how do you proceed with this examination? Are you following an algorithm, or how do you tailor it to the history of the patient?
Yeah, so another resource I wanted to throw out there, and hopefully there'll be a link associated with this podcast, is that through the American Academy of Neurology, just in the last 6 months, we worked on, myself and colleagues, a telehealth for patients with a vestibular disorder approach, kind of a document that is also freely accessible to all through the American Academy of Neurology website. And so I've come up with these kind of algorithms through trial and error over the last couple of years. What have I found to be the most and the least helpful? And so I have put that together in my mind and on paper. But really, I'm just kind of trying to understand. I mean, as with any patient, the history is most important, and I'm letting the history guide me, and I'm usually just mainly because of time constraints checking the one, two, or three things that I think are going to be most valuable to get things moving. And if a patient has a lot of ocular motor signs, then I'm going to need to see them in person. So what do I need to know right now to get things moving in their workup, and then I will see them in person soon. So telemedicine is really great for triaging and getting these patients to the right place, for instance. If a patient has symptoms of imbalance, I've found in particular, there are these optokinetic nystagmus apps, these optokinetic kind of flag or tape apps. And I don't particularly find them to be helpful. I don't really use them as an outpatient ever. But I found that, for instance, if you put that optokinetic stimulus on the app just in front of the camera, then for that patient, it's a full field optokinetic stimulus, or a full screen, I should say. And so I found that to be really helpful. And I've captured a dozen or so patients with progressive supranuclear palsy just by looking at their optokinetic nystagmus horizontally, which is often normal or pretty close to normal, and then vertically. They often will lose the fast phases, especially down and then up. You can also check oblique optokinetic nystagmus or saccades. And so optokinetic nystagmus is a really nice kind of screen, quick screen for saccades in pursuit. And I would always use that in a patient who has balance problems. Could there be PSP, for instance? So it really depends on the patient, their complaints, and what I think is most important at that time.
That sounds interesting. And I was actually looking into your collection on the Novel Library, which is online for free. And I've seen bits of your examinations, and you divided this into ocular motor disorders and vestibular disorders. And so in your experience, which tests do actually work online and which ones don't? Like, for instance, head impulse test and other tricks that you can use.
Right. So the head impulse test, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this as well, is really a big challenge virtually. So you're relying obviously on the patient, whether they're just moving their head spontaneously and you're looking for that refixation, that active head impulse test where the patient is applying the head impulse themselves does not work that well, as opposed to the passive head impulse test where the examiner is performing the head impulse in person. I've found we've had patients who come downtown for video head impulse tests. I know their VOR gains. I know that they have corrective saccades. I know that they have unilateral or bilateral vestibular loss. And in a lot of those patients, unless it's really severe, I am unable to clearly see those catch-up saccades when they're doing it to themselves at home.
Yes, I completely agree to that, because actually, active head impulses, and that's well studied, they hide these overt saccades. So in a way, active head impulses, they show you how good the patient is in compensating the loss, and the passive normal head impulse shows you how bad the patient is doing and exhibits the loss.
Right. So going along with what we both just said and agreed on, if a patient has the acute vestibular syndrome, which I think that patient is much more likely to call 911 or to go to the emergency department rather than to try to figure out how to set up a telemedicine appointment with one of us. But obviously the head impulse test is really, really important and one of the three components of the HINTS exam. So if you can't rely upon the head impulse test, then you really can't rely upon the HINTS exam. You can't apply the rules of HINTS in a patient who has the AVS at home. It can be pretty easy in that patient who has the AVS at home to figure out that this is central, right? Their speech is dysarthric. They have vertical diplopia or they have a skew. And you could look for that. You can do, I would probably say that a cover-uncover test would be easier than an alternate cover test just because of kind of the degrees of freedom and having the patient move and hold the camera simultaneously. But those patients, if they have reasonable vision in both eyes and they have askew, are also going to tell you that they have vertical diplopia. I would say that nystagmus is relatively easy to appreciate. So if a patient has AVS and has unidirectional nystagmus, that could be peripheral, but that could still be central. And that's why it's a three-step test and not a one-step test. So it's relatively easy to say that this is a central pattern, or this looks like it could be a central pattern virtually in the AVS, but I could never be confident that this is peripheral, that this is vestibular neuritis based on telemedicine alone.
Oh, yeah. And the other thing I thought was difficult is to diagnose and treat BPPV, because I don't think it's easy to record if you're rolling around in bed. And so I was wondering, which maneuvers do you counsel, or what do you do? Foster maneuver, I would think it's a good option because you can do it on the floor.
Right. Yeah, I mean, so safety is key. So in these patients, especially older patients, making sure that they're in a safe place, making sure that they're on their bed, they're on the floor, so that they don't fall off if they have BPPV is induced by the Dick's Hall Pike, then certainly you wouldn't want them to fall and hurt themselves. So safety is key, number one. Number two is trying to get the camera angles right. That can be a challenge. Trying to make sure that they're doing the maneuver correctly, that can be a big problem. But then if you need to see their head and body position, how are you going to see their eyes and see if there's nystagmus as well? So you'll see that in some of the videos that we've created, some of the resources, there are two cameras, but that's a lot to ask of the patient. So in a perfect world, we would be able to see everything, but typically we're not able to. So I've instructed and kind of guided patients through the Dick's Hall Pike, but you don't know exactly what is happening with their head and body. You can see the eyes. You can look for nystagmus. I've seen quite a few patients with BPPV and been able to diagnose them that way. But then the treatment part is tough. And I have handouts that I've been sending, virtual handouts and PDFs and things like that. Here's a home epley. Here's sort of a modification. Why don't you try this? Step one. Step two. Here's how to position. Here's how to put where to put the pillow. So in some patients, I think more so patients who have a good range of motion, typically who are younger, can do home epleys and home repositioning maneuvers successfully. But we have a lot of really good vestibular physical therapists around here. So really, I've been, even if I ask them to do home epleys, I've almost 100% of the time been asking them to make an appointment with one of our local PTs as well.
So are you also aware of any apps with which patients could do these maneuvers offline without your help? So apps that are guiding the patients?
Yeah, so I think so guidance would be key, and having an app where you just click the screen and it goes from step one to step two and it shows you everything. It shows you what you should be doing, where to hold the camera, how to position the head. That would be great. We have talked about that. We have thought about that, but I am unaware of any such resource. Are you?
You know, in Switzerland, the country is much smaller, so we can usually bring the patients in or they are coming, unless there's the COVID pandemic. Maybe can you talk a little bit more about what happened, or how did you handle this problem?
Right. I mean, I guess when the patients stopped coming to the emergency department, the patients stopped calling for appointments because they also didn't know that telemedicine was an option. Telemedicine wasn't an option on day one or two. It did take some weeks to get that infrastructure set up. So at the beginning, there weren't a lot of patients and I had a lot of time. And so I could go through this sort of the complete battery and do everything and test things out and see what worked and what didn't. At the beginning, there were far less licensure issues as well. So I could see patients in other states because those states had waivers in place and emergency kind of restrictions were forgotten about. So I was able to really extend my reach to other states immediately with only my Maryland state license. But unfortunately, as the years have gone by, almost all of those states have the waivers have run out, they've expired. So now I'm back to some, sort of Maryland and DC. So I'm not sure that I answered your question, but it was everybody was learning. And honestly, because there were less patients, we were able to spend more time with them. And so we could kind of play around and kind of go through a lot of the resources and kind of the kinds of videos and examination techniques, as you can see in my through some of the resources that can be linked to.
Okay, so based on your experience, do you think you can make yourself redundant in the future by KI or even using this chatbot GPT, which is a hot topic right now?
Yeah, so here at Hopkins, my colleagues and peripherally myself are very heavily involved in developing apps. So apps for your iPhone that can record your eye movements, that can perform the head impulse test and actually give you gains just simply based on measurements, the velocity of the head versus the velocity of the eyes. So we are already kind of trying to think about the future and think about what apps can do that are $30,000 goggles can do, but are obviously limited by the costs, and they're not disseminated throughout a bunch of emergency departments. It's just one or two. So in doing so, if we could bring that technology to people's homes, that's a lot of patients potentially, and too many patients for the very few subspecialists who are out there. So how could we use artificial intelligence to automate some of this so that artificial intelligence could make those clear-cut diagnoses, the BPPVs, the AVS, the clear vestibular neuritis and clear central cases, central AVS? So I think that is the future. I think that automation is the future to hopefully take care of the easier cases for us and kind of leave the more nebulous cases of dizziness for us, the subspecialists. Regarding the chatbot, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that I have any specific thoughts, but maybe I should check today. Maybe the chatbot's better at diagnosing and treating dizziness than I am. I'm not sure.
Okay, so we're certainly looking forward to your virtual dizzy doc. And to wrap this up, so could you give us some thoughts or recommendations how to try it at home?
Yeah, I think that telemedicine, especially for the ocular, motor, and vestibular systems, can be really, really effective in the right patients with the right kind of lighting conditions and technology. I would say even if the video isn't working, we're very good at even over the telephone triaging, right? Making that telephone diagnosis of BPPV, here's who you need to see. But I think that telemedicine, the virtual examination of eye movements in the vestibular system, can be really good at triaging, usually getting the diagnosis correct in the hands of somebody who knows how to take the dizzy history and knows how to interpret the findings. But it is complementary to the in-person examination and to other lab tests and neuroimaging and consulting with our colleagues in movement disorders and physical therapy, etc. But I think it's a really good way to get things started. And hopefully if you can spend 10 minutes in telemedicine consultation with a patient who can be at their home, they don't have to come all the way to your hospital, your institution, and you're saving them a lot of time, it's really good at getting that person to the right place or getting things moving quickly so that they don't have to wait 3 months for that in-person appointment.
Okay, so if you want to know more and see what Dan Gold is actually doing, have a look at his videos and the links that we will certainly be providing. And thanks to Dan Gold for getting up early, and all the best. And with this, I'd like to conclude this podcast, and I'm sure there will be another one. Goodbye, everybody.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.